But Howard, Reel 3. But you were just telling me how everything got suddenly organised on the beach of Dunkirk.
Yes. And I think it was one of our own officers. I'm not certain who it was. But we were then organised into parties. And we went up along this jetty. They were able to get a warship in. I can't remember the name of the warship I was on, but we went up to this jetty, and the oil refinery was all black smoke on the right, and we went across this plank where the hole in the jetty had been blown away. We went on this plank across and onto this warship. And eventually, I mean, I went down, I was sent down onto the lower deck, and eventually they got as many as they could on there, and away we went. And again, being on the lower deck, I never actually saw what was happening outside. But we were given a drink by the Navy. Funny enough, all the people on, well, as far as I know, I got one, a drink on the destroyer. And I could hear the AK-AK guns going up above, but we were just lying about on the deck of the Muslim, and away we were so tired. I think a lot of us just dropped off, and we had an uneventful trip into Dover.
Was that in daylight that you were evacuated? Or was it night time?
No, I think it was in the daylight. Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, because you could see the line of, you could see the line of troops lining up.
And what equipment did you have left with you at that time?
Well, funny enough, I had my haversack, I had my water bottles and what have you, and I also had my rifle, and I brought my rifle back as far as Dover. And that's where I had to leave it before we were put on the trains to go wherever.
So what happened when you arrived at Dover?
Well, we were escorted, well, not escorted, we were marshalled onto a train and locked in, funny enough. The doors were locked and the ladies come along and give us cups of tea and writing paper and that, all cards. So we could send off to let our relations know that we were safe and what have you. And then we moved off. And funny enough, my hometown was Red Hill. And we stopped in Red Hill with this train. And we were transferred then. If I'd known as much as I do now, I could have hopped off the train and gone home. But there you are. Never give it a thought at the time. Because I'm certain that they wouldn't have known I was home. I could have done a bunk easy. But there you are. From there, where did I go from there? Blandford, I think it was. There. And I still had grenades in my pouch, even on the train. It was at Blandford where we had to unload all our ammunition on a parade ground, and we were billeted out on Blandford camp, and then eventually we were all reorganised. The people from the battalion had gone all different ways. I mean, I went to Dover and Blandford, and there weren't many of our people there. You know, you had anybody who was on the train was there, and eventually they sorted us out, and we went to Gainsborough, or Hall Green of Birmingham, and Gainsborough. Oh, I think we went to Oxford. We were transferred different places, but Gainsborough was where we more or less got reorganised as a battalion. C Company, we were in Gainsborough itself, and I was billeted on a private house. He was manager of the co-op, Gainsborough. I can't remember his name now, but we done very well there. And eventually we were reorganised into companies, and I don't know whether it was from Gainsborough. We eventually finished up at Walton on the Hill in Surrey.
And with this, you'd arrived back and you had you been issued with new equipment or uniforms? Or?
Not then, no. Well, I still had my own equipment, except for a rifle. I still had my own tin hat, my pack. I can't remember about my pack, and because your big pack wasn't always with you. I mean, you travel with your haversack and your water bottle and your pack would normally travel by transport to wherever you're going, and you'd pick it up. I think we must have lost all that in Dunkirk, because I never had no big pack. I had a small one, but we must have been issued again with great coats, because you that had been in your big pack. But the smaller thing, like your ground sheet, which is in your haversack, you still carried. I still had with me. But eventually we were reorganised, and we got rifles again. And one or two different Sten gun came out, which was another automatic weapon which served its purpose. But again,
I've heard people say how give bad reports sometimes of the Sten gun. Did you come across that at all?
They were slapped together. It was just like a bit of barrel with a spring in it and fired the running rifle. You know, nothing like the Bren gun or anything like that. The mechanisation of the Bren gun was entirely different. It was an automatic weapon. The only thing is that with the Bren gun, you had your held your bullets. What they call them?
The magazines.
The magazines only held what, X amount of rounds. 30, was it? But the time you fired a burst, or a short burst, you had to change the magazine. With the Sten gun, you had a little short, but the bullets were smaller. And you had about the same amount in one of them, about 20, I suppose.
Could you fire a single shot with a Sten gun?
Yeah. And with the Bren gun, you could fire a single shot.
With the Sten gun, was there a problem with it ever going off accidentally that you were aware of?
Not that I know of. No. We used to have one, I think there was one in each section at the time. You had a Bren gun and a Sten gun, 2-inch mortar in the platoon. Nothing really heavy. But then they brought out an anti-tank rifle, which was a little bit heavy. Again, on reflection, waste of time. Because I never used it on a tank. And I never did see it used on a tank. But I would imagine it would just bounce off.
Was this the boys' anti-tank rifle?
Yeah, I think it was.
Is it a long barrel affair?
Yeah. But, and then eventually they brought out a short pier anti-tank thing. But again, you've got to be pretty close to a tank to make that effective. And again, I never actually saw it used in... because again, I'm talking about tanks in Burma. There wasn't many tanks Japanese things, not like France and what have you. Of course, coming out of Dunkirk, I never actually saw a big German tank or anything like that.
Can I ask you what the casualties to the battalion have been at Dunkirk?
Quite heavy, I would think. A lot of them were prisoners of war because of that Nieppe Forest I was telling you about. I'm certain that D Company, a lot of them were prisoners of war. My own company, C Company, quite a few eventually got back into Britain, but I never actually saw them in transport from, you know, in, on the way back.
Was everybody drifting in during that period when you just got back to the UK?
Yeah, yeah.
In small groups?
Well, like I said, we went to Blandford. Other people went to different places. And eventually we were all transferred back to an area where we were reformed. And I think it was Oxford where we started to reform the battalion. And then we went to Gainsborough. We got reinforcements and made into a battalion again.
And what had the morale of the battalion been? Had it been affected by being at Dunkirk?
A bit despondent because, you know, a lot of your mates were not there. I remember getting back to this. A friend of mine at Oxford, he got wounded on the way back, and I managed to get him onto a transport and got him away. I never did see him until I got back into Blighty, and he managed to get back because he was wounded. But you lost touch with people on the retreat to Dunkirk, except with people on the carrier. I mean, I never met anybody else. Didn't want to meet anybody else. We were, on reflection, it's a wonder we got there. But, petrol-wise, I mean, they must have carried enough petrol to get us to Dunkirk. Lucky, fortunate to get there, really.
Did you feel at the time that you'd actually almost been bloodied in action, you'd experienced your first action, and that you now knew what you might be up against in the future?
My impression was that we never had enough to combat the strength of the bloody Germans, really. I mean, they had everything, we had nothing, really. Few brain gun carriers, we never had any tanks as such. And although the brain gun carriers were mobile and they'd done a good job, but they're open, aren't they? They're open to all sorts of things. You only got to get a mortar shell near them and you're gone. But we never had the equipment was terrible, really. And it wasn't until later years when you can start putting one against the other, you feel that you can do a good job. I mean,
were you promoted at this period when you were reforming at Gainsborough?
Yeah. I went to Lance Corporal and Sergeant within the 12 months, and it was when we were walking on the hill when I was sergeant there, where we started doing quite a lot of training and that. And I might tell you that to get a bath, we had to march from walking on the hill to Red Hill to the swimming baths at Red Hill to have a bath, and then march back again. So the bath, what we had, didn't do you any good whatsoever. I mean, those sort of things. You might just well let us have a tap outside and have a wash outside. But again, I suppose it was training, endurance marches, because that's eventually, I mean, that's a lot of it was marching through Burma and what have you. And those marches we had to ready on must have helped us to do the sort of thing.
Did you feel at that time that your stamina and your fitness, general fitness level, was improving?
Well, I felt quite well, really. I mean, everybody, you hardly see a chap drop out. I mean, what, walking on the other ready on back, what, 12 miles each way? It's a long way to march, but you never see hardly anybody drop out. And throughout my career on the marches, very few people dropped out. So it goes well for the stamina of the young lads.
Can I ask you a question about that? With boots, did you ever have a problem with your army boots at all?
Personally, no. I never had any trouble at all. I never really had bad feet, blisters or anything like that through the marching. Whether it's because we'd done so much of it, our feet had got so hard. But I always had a nice fitting pair of boots. You know, funny enough, we used to go along and have a pick your boots. You could try your boots, you know, but they weren't quite tight fitting, or they weren't loose. I done very well out of boots.
You said that not many people dropped out of March, but were there people who suffered with poor feet?
Oh, yeah. Quite a few had blisters. And they could have, it could have been shoes, boots, whatever. But the old medical orderlies used to slap them up with a bit of plaster and what have you, and they still carried on. The medical orderlies done a great job, and yet they were only ordinary people, really, that had done medical training. Well, medical training.
Had you been used to wearing boots in your job?
Oh, yeah.
Before, when you were a gardener, before?
Yeah, I had heavy boots on in the garden, which, again, would probably have helped me. If you're digging a garden, spades and what have you, no good wearing shoes. All the way along, kept my old toenails trimmed and what have you, and looked after you. You have to look after your feet. And we used to, somehow or other, I used to get foot powder. I don't think it was issued. I must have bought it. But I always used to use powder in the socks and that when I could get it.
Did you have foot inspections?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always had foot inspections. All the usual inspections, really. You know, hands and, the old usual drop your trousers at effort, you know, with the MO. They were pretty regular. And, of course, later on, we had salt parades, you know, in Burma, because of the sweat and what have you. We had to have parades and make certain the men took salt water. A lot of them didn't like it, but they are. And the other thing that we had parades was for Mepocrine. The Mepocrine tablets for malaria. But no, all those sort of parades, funny enough, they seemed to have supplies, like Mepocrine tablets. I mean, I think later on, just recently, they never had enough, did they, for malaria.
As well, was there an emphasis, obviously going back while you're still in the UK, was there an emphasis on cleanliness as well within general cleanliness for all the soldiers?
I used to have knit crate. Not necessarily very often, but I always remember the old knit crate to make certain you hadn't got any louse or anything like that. No, though, on the whole, I think that side of the administration was quite good.
And obviously, as you're being promoted at this period, you would have taken a more active role in guard duties and drilling and that side of things.
Yeah. Being a large corporal, I mean, I wasn't guard commander, but I was used to have a corporal or sergeant guard commander, and then you had a large corporal along with your guard, and the large corporal used to have to take the guards around. But eventually, guard commander, when you were a sergeant or even a corporal, I mean, you used to get all the officers come round during the night and tell the sentry to stand to the guard, and we used to have to go out and stand to them. We used to sleep on the old tables and had the old bench type seats in the guard room. You used to sleep on them with your pack as a pillar, ready for being called out. Now, the old guard was a bit, because you were inspected before you went on by the RSM and the ordinary officer, and they'd either tell you to get your hair cut or do something or other. They always seemed to pick bone, not me as a sergeant, because I went round with them, but they'd always seem to pick on some minor item of a bloke's equipment that it wasn't just right, just to make certain they were important. But again, it was discipline, I suppose. But then when I was promoted sergeant, I got sent away on different courses and whatever. I went on a gas course. I went through all the different gases they use. Dorking.
Can you explain to me what you have to do with the gas course?
One particular instance, we were put outside in the evening time, as though you were standing too, because when you were in action, you stood to just before it get dark, and then they stand you down, and just before it got light, you'd stand to in the morning, ready for any first attacks. And this particular time at this gas school, we were putting these trenches outside of the building with your gas masks and what have you, and you see this cloud coming towards you. And you've got to decide whether it's gas or whether it's just ordinary smoke. And of course, the first reaction is you see this cloud of gas. Well, everybody put the gas mask on. And it turned out to be smoke or something. But then they would mix some chemical with it, so it would give you a bit of an eye spot. And then you found out you'd made a mistake. But it was all good training, really, because the first thing you've got to, if you see a cow come, first reaction is, all that bloody gas on with your mask. But it didn't always work out that way.
How are you supposed to tell that it could be something else? Had they let you smell chemicals?
Yeah, it is the smell. And they give a little bit of irritation to your eyes, and that when, if you want to, it's the same as, they had a compartment, it was just like a pillbox thing. You went in one door and you came out the other, and you've been through without a gas mask on. You know, you'd gone through this stuff, and you then knew that you'd been through something, and it could be what was the type of gas? I can't remember the name of the gas, but mustard gas. They give it a little tap on it to show you the effects of a mustard gas.
And what would that be?
Yeah, a blister. Yeah. It becomes a blister. It shows you what the effects of the gaps. So, I mean, fortunately, we never had any during the war as such. But if we'd have found somebody with a, you'd known in mustard gas. No, it was interesting. I've got good reports on it. Then I went on another course when I was sergeant, anti-tank mines and booby traps. There's a big house at Kingswood, a summer house there, and the sappers had done it all up, you know, and you had to make certain you got in it without setting any off, you know, like going through the window. You'd make certain the window wasn't booby trapped, and then when you went through the window, when you landed on the floor, whether you're going to set a booby trap off when you. And it's, you know, it was all good training if ever you run into it, you know. And when you open the door, you know, if you push the latch up, bang,
a thunder flash,
detonator or whatever, and you knew you'd made mistakes, but that's a way to learn. I remember going through the window, that's what I say. And I put my foot down. I made certain the sash window was okay, but when I got through the window and put my foot on the floor, there's a loose floorboard, and away he went. A method of learning, and I learned.